Women remain underrepresented in elected office at every level of government. This is according to research, including a recent study conducted by the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. What are the barriers or hurdles that exist to getting women to run for office? And how can more women be encouraged to do so? Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Anna Huntsman, in today for Jenny Hamill. Coming up, we'll talk to a political expert as well as women who are currently or were formally elected to run their cities. Then, innovation is the cornerstone of most product development, helping to make products better and less expensive. But that's not the case with our healthcare system. We'll talk with a prominent healthcare economist about why our system discourages such innovation. Plus, the winners of the 89th Annual Anisfield Wolf Book Awards are revealed. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Anna Huntsman, in for Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us. Women make up half of the population, but are underrepresented in elected government positions. Underrepresentation exists at every level of government, federal, state, and local. Last year, the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University researched the number of women mayors, or women performing mayoral duties, in cities or towns with populations greater than 30,000. Its study found just 26% of those positions were held by women. Voters in Cleveland and Akron have recently given the reins of power to new generational leaders in Justin Bibb and Shamas Malik, respectively, but Cleveland has only elected one woman as mayor in its history. Akron has elected none. We're going to talk today about some of the hurdles and barriers women face in running for office. And we're going to talk to current and former women mayors about their experiences. Joining me in studio is Dr. J. Cherie Strawn. She is the director of the Bliss Institute of Applied Politics at the University of Akron and a professor of political science. She's also co-authored a textbook on this very subject, Why Don't Women Rule the World? Understanding Women's Civic and Political Choices. Hi, Cherie. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
By phone, we are joined by Janet Weir Creighton. She is the former mayor of Canton, the only woman elected to that post so far, and a current Stark County commissioner. Hi, Janet. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much. I love being on the program, and hello to the doctor. I had the pleasure of working with her. Thank you.
Yes, that's right. And also by phone, we have Mayor Kim Thomas of Richmond Heights. We should note before we begin that Mayor Thomas is recovering from vocal cord surgery. Hi, Mayor. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anna. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Very excited to get this conversation going. If you would like to join the conversation, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org. You can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Okay, Cherie, let's start with you. Like I mentioned before, we talk about these statistics. You know, I mentioned Cleveland has only had one female mayor. Akron has never had any. Does that surprise you?
No. We originally thought, women political scientists who studied running for office, so my predecessors in the field thought that after Title IX, after the second wave, you know, women would have access to the same kinds of educational experiences and careers as men. There was one regression model, you know, originally cited from way back then that said women would hit parity by 2006. And we know that's not happened. And we know that we have hit a plateau, and, you know, nowhere are we seeing, you know, you cited that 26%. It hovers around that same percentage in Congress, in the Senate. It hovers around that same percent in state legislatures. So we have hit a wall, and it's not because when women run, they are just as likely to win as men. It's because we cannot get more women to run for office. It's a pipeline issue.
Interesting. So let's talk about that pipeline issue. In your research, what factors have you found that prevent women from running for office or entering politics?
So the research, what happens is that adolescents have the same levels. Boys and girls both anticipate running for office. Not very many think they're going to do that. So about 14%. When women become college aged, so hit those adult, 18, 19, 20, you know, start to think about going to college or putting their lives together, women's political ambition or the thought that they should run for office drops to 7%, and it never recovers. So we're just you know, you're just dealing with half the population of women thinking that they should be planning their lives or their careers around running for office, and it never bounces back up. So there's a whole host of reasons.
Interesting. And I want to talk about that a little bit more, you know, later on as well. But I do want to bring Janet Weir Creighton into the conversation here. You've had a distinguished career in politics. So I'm curious, what initially drew you into that?
What initially drew me into that, excuse me, is someone asked me to do it, asked me to get involved in politics. And I always tell everyone, once I was bitten by the bug, I never found the cure. And I did make a bold move in running in 1984 for county recorder. And I will tell you that many people don't know my story, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but suffice to say, I was rejected originally by my own Republican Party. And it made me so mad that I said, okay, boys, I'm going to show you what I can do, and I've never looked back.
What was the rejection there? What was their reasoning?
There was an appointment process. The county commissioners appointed me at the time, the interim, and then the party had to meet, and they ran five men. I was the only woman. The chairman of the party, I felt, was really anti-woman. The man won, so they really, you know, they told me they didn't want me, and they made me pledge I wouldn't run in the primary. Well, I would not make that pledge because that's what elections are for. They're about choice. So I ran against the gentleman in the primary. I beat him and went on to win the general election.
Wow. So as you continued to climb and win other elections and positions, did you continue to face any additional hurdles because you were a woman, or did things seem to improve? Or, you know, talk about your experience then.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me just say, too, after I won, then, quote, I became like the darling of the party because I was a woman and I won. So then they forgot that. Then I went on to run for other things. I will tell you, early in my career, remember in 84, there were not a lot of women running for office.
Sure.
And I was a divorced mother of two children, and there were women that did not like that. They felt that I should not be running for office. I will tell you, back then I was criticized by the way I wore my hair, the types of shoes I wore, because I was divorced, that I dated men. And I mean, it was kind of bizarre when I think back, you know, to that time, because they don't pick on men the same way that they pick on the women.
I want to bring Mayor Kim Thomas into the conversation because you are currently serving as mayor of Richmond Heights. So tell us how you got into politics, and have you had to face any hurdles directly because you are a woman?
Hey, Anna, thank you for asking. So I started off as a grassroots organizer, started off helping other elected officials get elected to office. And it was 2016, the Hillary election, when she lost. That is when I got engaged into politics. I was also one of the vice chairs of the Cuyahoga County Democratic Party, and I had a fire underneath me. I just wanted to see women run for office. Not only run, but I wanted to make sure they won. And so for me, as you talk about the barriers, there's a lot of barriers that women face. And I know in my circle, we talk about why women fear running for office. And some of those include feeling unqualified, lacking network, fearing judgment, and grappling with the limited resources and limited time. But I think it's essential that we as women empower each other to engage in politics and to help them to navigate, help all the women navigate the challenges that comes our way every day, and to turn those aspirations into impactful actions. And so again, it is critical for the future of the women to be in the room and make those decisions that really impact the women that we fight for every day. But I listened to the professor. The good news, we are making strides on getting women to run for office. And I think she mentioned that in Congress now we have 26%. And so we are not there yet, but we are making strides. And running for office, again, can be scary. I remember when I decided to run for mayor in Richmond Heights. It's no secret the first African-American woman ran, she got recalled. And so here I am coming right behind her years later. And I had guys calling, saying, we're going to recall you as well. And so one thing about me, I don't scare easy. So I continue to do what I need to do. And that was organize and mobilize. But in recent times, there's been groups that organize to support female candidates and help them raise money. Groups like the Cuyahoga County Democratic Women's Caucus, Cindy Dempsey, she's a rock star who endorsed me, and I'm also a member of that group, and the Black Women's PAC, Emily's List. And so these are the groups who made it their mission to help women run for office and to make sure they get elected in all branches of government. And so for me right now, the bottom line is I encourage everyone, just do it, jump in, organize, and then have a plan, because you know you're going to have some challenges that's going to arise. But I promise you, those challenges, you can get over. You just have to transform those challenges into opportunities. Mm-hmm. So, oh, absolutely. I have challenges on a daily basis. Another thing that I can I want to share is the double standards. Mm. You know, we live in this world with double standards where I mean, they come at you. We know that the double standards are out there for women, and often we're held at a far different standards than men. But we also know that we can handle anything that's thrown our way. Many men leaders have women as their assistants. And as we know, the women are doing most of the heavy lifting, and the men get to credit. And so, I mean, I can go on and on talking about this.
Sure.
Other thing I always share is that women often earn less than men. That's another reason sometimes women say, you know what, should I jump into this? Will we get equal pay, equal work? Good. Right now, it's we're at that place, we will, but we're still there's strides that we need to make.
Sure.
In 2015, I think it was, the gender gap was 73%. Today is 83%. And so we're not 100% there, but we are getting better. And we also have to remember that we're not far away from the significant gender gap, this discrimination that was allowed in this nation. In 1970, women received fewer benefits than men.
Right,
and could be
right.
denied jobs because they were in their childbearing age. And so, you know, the interracial marriage.
And let's kind of talk about where that's at, where we are at today now with Cherie.
Yeah.
You know, I'm hearing kind of a common theme with both Janet and Kim, which is they have this incredible drive and ambition. So they've experienced challenges, they've faced some hurdles and rejection. But, you know, you hear Kim saying, I don't scare easy. You hear Janet saying, let's show these boys what I can do.
Yeah.
So it seems like it maybe takes some of that drive. But I have to imagine that can't be all.
So I heard two things that resonates with the larger research findings. One is the importance of being asked. Gender socialization plays such an important role from the time that we're children all the way up through our current colleagues and family networks. Women, young girls will express an interest in some sort of policy agenda, and they'll be told you should run a nonprofit or you should volunteer. Mm. And little boys will be encouraged to run for office. And the same, even when women are lawyers or have public-facing careers, their colleagues are much less likely to encourage them to run. And so just the sheer importance, and I heard you know, that being said, I was asked to run, is a trigger. The other reason then, when women actually do step up and run, it's oftentimes because they got angry about something, right? So why do we have a 1992 year of the woman? Why do we see more women running in the Trump era? It's women who have never really thought about planning their career or staging their career around a political aspiration. All of a sudden, something happens and it triggers them. So in 92, it was the Clarence Thomas hearings and Anita Hill. More recently with Trump, it was the groping comments or Hillary Clinton losing or, you know, some of the other, the Dobbs decision. And you'll see women kind of just say, well, this made me angry. I'm going to throw my hat in the ring and I'm going to do it. I'm going to go for that primary, even if the party oftentimes still will say it's not your time yet. You have to wait. And they'll support men over women sometimes. And so those are the two things that I saw popping out that really resonate with the literature.
What about when it comes to the voters, though? I mean, we heard Janet saying she was criticized for how she looked or how her hair looked. Is that still happening today when women run? I mean, do we still see that, or have we made, I don't know, I guess some improvements? Or what do voters actually think when this happens?
So one of the things I would just want to reiterate for the women listening is when women run, they are just, if you control for incumbency and, you know, ability to raise funds and the partisanship makeup of your constituency, women are just as likely to win as men. They're also more risk averse and plan a little bit more typically, and maybe try to plug some experiences in. So they tend to be better prepared candidates, right, because they've been doing the behind the scenes work that we just heard about. But they also run a different gauntlet. Absolutely, we still get asked questions about who's watching your children. If you have children, men don't get asked, right? They're in childcare, they're at school. Men don't get asked those questions. Women are asked to sort of justify leaving the domestic sphere. Women have to answer questions about their clothing, their attire, you know, hyper scrutiny on our appearance. I teach my students a tactic, because when I want women to run, you also have to prepare them that they are going to run a different gauntlet. I teach my students a tactic called name it, shame it, pivot, and tell them to practice it until it's muscle memory. Hmm. Someone throughout your campaign will say something sexist. Or if you're a minority woman, they will say something racist and sexist, like the combination, right, of the comments. And if you don't have that muscle memory to say, that wasn't okay to say to me, you know, you shouldn't be focusing on the fact that, you know, I'm a black woman or, you know, I'm a woman. You should be focusing on my leadership capacity, because here's the policy issue why I should be the one to lead the charge on this. If that's not muscle memory, it can be shocking when people say obnoxious things to you and you'll freeze. So, yes, women run a different gauntlet. Yes, there are barriers. Right now we're seeing increases. I don't think we knew it until the Me Too movement really kind of revealed it, how much women were exposed to threats and violence when they put themselves in leadership positions. And we're kind of seeing an escalation of that right now, just the climate right now in the country. Mm. So, yeah, definitely run a different gauntlet, but you absolutely can win.
Former Mayor Creighton, you're now a commissioner, so you've held several, you know, elected, or you hold elected office now. You have to be reelected, so you're still in this game here. So I'm curious, is this conversation resonating with you? What do you see now versus when you first started in politics?
Well, I do think we have come along a long way, and women have to encourage other women to run. My biggest thrill in politics is mentoring other women. And also I will mentor men, but I mean, I really love mentoring the young ladies, because it is a different path that they have to take. I don't think we're quite as critical, at least I don't hear it as much, and maybe it's because I've been around for a long time. Well, now they attack me because of my age. I mean, I've had men say to me, I was, just as a note, a few years ago, I was elected the chairman of the Stark County Republican Party. So I have that role and also my elected role. And I had a man tell people that they should not vote for me because I was a woman and I was too old. And I really took high offense to that. Those kinds of comments should not be made. I agree that we should be judged on our ability and what we can bring to the table. And I will also tell you, right, wrong, or indifferent, I don't always vote for a woman just because she's a woman. She has to bring something to the table. I'm looking for the most qualified individual that can serve in that position. So I have seen some things kind of simmer down, then other things boil up. But, you know, I'm coming to the end of my career in public service, and, you know, I've appreciated the opportunity that my voters have given me. And I think that I have proven myself, because that's why I've been reelected.
I feel like I might already know the answer to this question, but did you ever feel like you had to change your personality to accommodate the job or expectations? I mean, just hearing the criticisms, did you ever feel like you had to be someone you're not?
Oh no. You know what? I keep saying to my husband, I need to quit being so, you know, direct and quit and, you know, whatever. And he keeps saying, Janet, you've been this way all your life. Why would you change now? So the answer is no. Be who you are. Be true to yourself. You know, when you run for office, you are taking a risk. And I think that's what limits a lot of women in running. They're afraid because once you become an official or you run for office, your life is under a microscope. And I always reminded my children when they were little that they were also under the microscope and they better not embarrass their mom.
Cherie, is this something you've heard from women in your research? Do they feel like they have to change or be someone different, or does the fear, you know, keep them from running?
Some of the hyper scrutiny, anytime women step into male dominated professions or even hobbies or interests, and politics is still the sort of the hyper masculine, you know, good old boys club is still perceived that way. Anytime we step into those roles and put ourselves forward for leadership positions, we're hyper scrutinized. Prove it again. Can you really do it? It's like telling someone you're a football fan, right? And then being asked all the stats because they don't really believe that women like football. And the hyper scrutiny over the years can cause imposter syndrome, and that causes hesitancy or, you know, the feeling that you might need to modify or change yourself. And the advice I give my students is very similar to what we just heard, is find ways to be a little bit Teflon. Find ways or find your fan club. You know, who is that? You know, who are those circle of other women, other good colleagues? They could be men too, who will tell you all the reasons why you should run for office or all the reasons why your personality is suited, right? Your directness, your agency, your leadership capacity. That doesn't mean you're bossy. That means you're a good leader. So surround yourself by people who will help you correct, right, and reject sort of absorbing that sort of criticism and commentary.
Mayor Kim Thomas, I do want to point out that she is recovering from vocal cord surgery. But I wanted to, you know, ask you this as well. Did you feel like you ever had to change, or are you really honing in on your personality? You know, did you face that as a barrier?
And when I show up in a room, I show up as myself. But more importantly, and Doctor, thank you for mentioning just showing up and bouncing ideas off of strong women. I have a group of women that are my mentors. And so those are the ones that I lean on, and they give me the strength to be able to show up. And when I do show up as Kim Thomas. So again, just having that circle of friends that you can trust and that will call you out when you're wrong, or if I'm about to say something or do something, I'll run an idea by my women's group and they'll say, no, we're going to put a pause to that. You may want to rephrase what you're going to say. So absolutely, just having those strong mentor women to help lead you and guide you and showing up as you are.
Sure. I feel like during this conversation, we've talked a lot about some different strategies of how to encourage more women to run. And we've talked about, you know, the voters think pretty much the same for the most part about male and female candidates. But Cherie, I did want to point out another aspect of this, and I've just seen some discourse about this on Twitter, or X, I should say. But the reality is that women are still, in many cases, the primary caregivers and maybe juggling the family demands more so than a man. Is that still something that we're seeing, and how do you approach that, and what are you saying to the young women out there?
Yeah, we still see which, again, I think women from that first or from that second wave thought we would have made more progress on sharing domestic responsibilities. And particularly with young children, women are still doing, women in traditional marriages, women with traditional heterosexual relationships and marriages are doing the bulk, especially of young, right, infant care and toddler care. So one of the things that does hold women back is this, can they juggle a job, the household, and then running for office on top of it. In experimental design with college students, they asked young college students, women, if they'd be willing to run for office, and they moved the district, right? So they gave them a map and said, would you be willing to run for office? One of the districts was close enough to drive to the Capitol to, you know, to be able to get back and forth, and the other was, you know, further away where you'd have to stay in a hotel or, you know, it would be difficult to get home. Women, if they could get home to put dinner on the table, right, could get home to pick the kids up from school, were much more likely to say they would step up and run. So I have my students do an experiment or do a little thought experiment in class. And I say, at what point in a romantic relationship, if you want to run for office and this is your career aspiration or something that you see in your future, at what point with a romantic partner do you have serious conversations about who's going to share those responsibilities? Because part of putting your life together is finding a partner who supports your long-term ambitions. And if someone doesn't want to do that, maybe that's not the right person for you. I don't tell them how to make those decisions or when that conversation, but I say that it should be on your radar screen to be thinking about ways to get the support you need to be fulfilled.
Yeah. Janet, you want to talk about this as well? I mean, how did you navigate, you know, handling family demands and running for office? And what do you tell young women out there about this?
Remember when I first ran, it was 1984. Yeah. So my children were small and I was divorced. And, you know, it was a juggling act. And I think back, I wonder how I got through it. You make it work. I hate to use this term, but I have always believed that women are better at multitasking. I mean, we run households. We do more than one thing at a time. And I think that, you know, I had to find that balance. But I also, you know, had latchkey children, which has always placed a guilt on me, quite frankly. And I'm proud that both of my children have turned out to be fabulous and they're educated and have wonderful jobs. But you find a way to do it. Women do. And then as they grew older and I ran for more and more things, then they were there always being very supportive.
Hmm. Kim, you're currently serving in the role as mayor of Richmond Heights. How do you juggle all this?
It's really just prioritizing and my family. I lean very heavy on my family, so I get the support from them. So that is number one. When I get home, first thing I do, eat dinner, talk to my husband. He gives me the strength. So just making sure that everything is in line, and it started off having the support of my family.
That's wonderful to hear. We are going to have to end the conversation here soon, but Sheree, I just wanted to give you a quick 30 seconds here. Anything else you want to add to this conversation about encouraging women to run or the state of women in politics today?
Well, I think two things. One is just encourage every woman that you think has qualifications that would make her a good leader. And that could be, you know, being, you know, Nancy Pelosi said organizing five kids at home and keeping the household running was the thing that made her good at being Speaker of the House. So if you see women with policy issues and passions or women with organizing capacity and skills, women with public facing careers, they have not heard often enough that they should run for office. So encourage every woman that you think is qualified to run because they're not hearing it from other places. And then to the women who are here, I think have set a good example, lift while you lead. Encourage them to come up behind you and provide encouragement and mentorship so that we do get that pipeline so that when incumbents step out, there are other women to replace them.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it there. I feel like I could do an hour-long segment on this, but thanks so much to my guest today, Dr. J. Sheree Strawn of the Bliss Institute. Thanks for being here in studio. Mayor Kim Thomas of Richmond Heights and Stark County Commissioner and former Canton Mayor Janet Weir Creighton. Thanks so much to you all.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Time now for a quick break, but on the other side, we'll talk to a prominent health economist who's speaking at Case Western Reserve University today to talk about the dilemma of innovation in healthcare. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Anna Huntsman, in today for Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Anna Huntsman, in today for Jenny Hamill. Thanks for joining us. There are many examples in our economy of products getting better and cheaper over time, like light bulbs or cell phones, but that's not how it works in the U.S. healthcare system, according to prominent health economist Jim Rebitzer, who is coming to Case Western Reserve University today to speak about this dilemma in healthcare. Together with his twin brother Robert, who's also a healthcare consultant, Rebitzer wrote a book called Why Not Better and Cheaper that explores why there's not a lot of incentive to lower healthcare costs and that developing new life-saving innovations is not always valued. The result, they say, is our society is poorer and less healthy than it ought to be. Here to talk more about his new book is Dr. Jim Rebitzer, the Peter and Deborah Wexler Professor of Management at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. He was also the former chair of the economics department at Case Western Reserve University. Thanks for coming in the studio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Okay, let's talk about the origins of this book, which began with a thought your brother had that there's no money in finding ways to reduce healthcare costs.
Yeah, so my brother, who's a healthcare consultant and a strategic advisor, was working with an organization in California that was trying to figure out ways to deliver inexpensive care to low-income communities. And he was working on a camera or something. And he was very frustrated. He called me up and he said, you know, it's really a shame there's no way to make money reducing costs in healthcare. And I'm a health economist, and I said, that can't be right. That's just not right. And so months of discussion and arguments and fun ensued. And at the end of that and explorations, I said to him, I think there's a book here. And he fortunately agreed. So we wrote the book.
Awesome. Yeah. So a nice brotherly project here.
Oh, it's enormous fun.
That's wonderful. So, you know, you use the examples I mentioned in the book of the fact that over time, cell phones and light bulbs have gotten cheaper and the quality has improved. But what about the cost of healthcare? It's risen immensely over time. It continues to go up. So you start the book by looking at that at the very beginning. You know, what was the cost of care since the 1800s? Can you elaborate on that?
Well, we do talk about the cost of care, but the core question of the book is why doesn't healthcare get better and cheaper the way that the cell phones that we carry around in our pockets do? And our answer is that it's too easy to make money from mediocre innovations and too hard to make money from cost-reducing innovations. And, well, why is that? That's not the way innovation is supposed to work. Why does healthcare work that way? And we argue that it has to do with the nature of incentives and with the role of the way social norms work and professional norms work in the health sector, and also with the way competition works in the health sector. And those three things make it too easy to make money from not the best things. And so, when people talk about the healthcare system, they tend to focus on three vital signs. They tend to focus on cost, as you just did. You know, why does the U.S. healthcare system spend so much of GDP on healthcare? They tend to focus on quality. Why don't we get the quality that we want? And they tend to focus on access. A lot of the debates around Obamacare and insurance are about access. We're introducing a fourth vital sign, which is innovation. That if you don't pay attention to the quality of the innovations your healthcare system is generating, it ends up impoverishing the system and the society. So, yeah, because we don't care about costs per se. What we want is a healthcare system that delivers an enormous amount of value for what we spend. That's what we really care about. And ultimately, innovation is key to that.
Yeah, I want to expand a little bit more on your point that it's too easy to profit from mediocre or low-value innovations. Could you give an example?
I could give you two examples that will give you a flavor. One is around the patent system. And we take a very broad view of innovation. It's not just patented drugs and devices, but it's also treatment modalities. So let me give you two examples. The first is antibiotics. You can't have modern medicine without antibiotics. You can't have chemotherapy. You can't have most surgeries. They're miraculous things. But the thing is about antibiotics is that the bugs evolve. They find ways to evade the effectiveness of the antibiotics. And so you'd think, when ask yourself the question, you'd think that that would be a very profitable innovation, that the market test in the patent system, which is patents are invaluable unless people use it, that should be a really valuable patent. But in the case of antibiotics, the market test doesn't really work right. Why is that? Because the first thing you do with a new antibiotic is you don't use it, right? Because it tends to be expensive. It tends to be no more effective against the existing bugs. You want to keep it in reserve for the bugs who develop immunity. But in a patent system where you only make money on patents that people actually want to buy, well, that actually works against the incentive. So antibiotics, which ought to be an extremely high value, highly rewarded innovation, end up to be almost certain money losers. And so we've had an extremely slow development of antibiotics since the 1960s. And the world is at great risk because of that. And that's one example of many in which the patent, the market test and the patent system can pass over and not reward adequately high value innovations and reward other things that don't nearly produce as much social value. Let me give you another example from about treatments, again, from my brother's experience. Periodically, there's an institute at Stanford that calls him up because some bright engineer has a new idea, and what do you think? So this engineer calls him up and says, well, I figured out a way to change the way people walk. And if you alter their gait, it's like losing 20%, 15 to 20% of their body weight. And if I could teach people to do this, we'll save enormous amounts of money on knee replacements and hip replacements. And what do you think, Bob? And he said, well, if it works, it's a terrific innovation. It creates a lot of social value. He said, and is it a good business? And Bob said, that depends. Who's the customer? And then he goes through the customers. Well, let's look at the orthopedic surgeons. Would the orthopedic surgeons be interested in this? Well, maybe not so much, right? Because they're focused on replacing knees. Okay. So how about the healthcare systems? Would the healthcare systems be interested in this? Well, maybe not so much, because knee replacement is a high profitable, high throughput operation that they're pretty much invested in. It wouldn't be a high priority innovation. How about the patients themselves? Yeah, they'd be interested, but they'd have to take their direction from the orthopods. Well, okay. How about the payers, right? Medicare, Medicaid, the insurers, the employers. Yes, they'd be interested. They'd be very interested in this system. But how do they get the docs to do it, right? They can't tell people how to deliver care. They're not qualified. It would look bad. It would be illegitimate. So what do you do? Well, in other sectors of the economy, the natural fix that would evolve is the payers would share the savings they get from teaching people to change their gait with the providers, who would then have an interest in promoting the new innovation. In this case, it's more complicated, as it often is in healthcare, because let's say I teach you, Anna, how to walk in a way that you will postpone a knee replacement 15 years from now. How do I capture those savings if I'm an insurance company? 15 years from now, you're going to be working for another employer, employed by another insurer, maybe under Medicaid. There's no way I can capture the savings over time and use those to induce people to adopt it. So, and that's called a time horizon problem. And that time horizon problem is everywhere, in all kinds of chronic diseases in healthcare, managing diabetes, exercise. How do you capture future savings? It's a very, very difficult problem. So those are examples of kinds of high-value innovations that kind of go missing. Yeah. And they go missing for reasons having to do with incentives, social norms, and the way competition works.
I mean, my natural next question is, have you thought of any possible solutions? I mean, particularly given around the antibiotics aspect here, in the book you talk about maybe a subscription model for drug makers, kind of like Netflix. Can you talk about that?
Good. Yeah. Thanks for reading the book. I appreciate that.
we do our best here.
You do your best. You do your work. What you want to do, at least in the case of antibiotics, what you want to do is separate the revenues to the innovators from sales. You want to sort of say, we're going to reward you for developing these new antibiotics, even if we don't sell them. And a Netflix or subscription model is a natural way to do that. You pay upfront a per user fee for access to the drug, and then you sell the drug itself at very, very low cost. And that solves that problem. There are other problems in the patent system as well that tend to steer innovation in the wrong direction. And we outlined many of those and suggested fixes as we in the book.
Gotcha. Any other possible ways to incentivize innovation here?
Yeah.
I'm sure you've thought of many possible solutions.
Let me give you another example. Can I give you another example?
Absolutely.
Okay. So there's this idea that's been kicking around since the 1970s called hospital at home. Hospital at home is a way of delivering acute hospital care in people's homes. And there haven't been any randomized trials of it, but there have been a lot of studies, and it looks very promising. Patients like it. It looks like it reduces costs, and it probably makes it much easier to for hospitals to not have to do the expensive thing of expanding their capacity. So you have hospital at home been kicking around since the 1970s and was pretty much not taken up anywhere. And the until the COVID crisis. In the COVID crisis, CMS also decided, no, this is a good thing. We want to keep people out of the hospital if we can and deliver care outside the hospital if we can. And so CMS approved payments. And all of a sudden, all the private payers, because Medicare went along, all the private payers went along as well. Well, that's great, right? Except you have to ask yourself the question, why did our nimble, our in principle nimble private insurers wait until the slow-moving bureaucracy of two decades slow-moving bureaucracy of Medicare decide to do this innovation? Why did they drag their feet? And the answer is because this kind of hospital at home kind of innovation requires big upfront costs, and whoever is the payer who first decides to pay for hospital at home is going to have to carry all those upfront costs and not share them with the other payers. That's called, and so what one thing one needs to induce those kinds of innovations is to have somebody, Medicare is often one, but it could be a private payer, step up and be a jump starter. They have to be a big market leader, and they have to sort of say, we're publicly committing to this, and then all of a sudden that makes it very easy for other people to innovate. So being a jumpstarter and thinking about jumpstarting as a form of policy would be a important way for inducing all kinds of new innovations in the health sector.
You're speaking today at 4:30 at the Case Western Reserve University's School of Managers yearly Howard T. McMiller Memorial Lecture at the Alumni Center. Just give us kind of a preview of that speech, or what's your topic?
Yeah, the topic is going to be what we were talking about. I'm going to talk about
wonderful.
The book, but in a lot more detail. I'm going to go through many more examples and many more instances of valuable but missing innovations, and go through in much more detail and with funny stories.
Wonderful.
How policy can be improved.
Well, thank you for taking the time to give us a preview here. Dr. Jim Rebitzer, the Peter and Deborah Wexler Professor of Management at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. We have the link to register for the lecture at today's show page, ideastream.org/SOI. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Anna.
Time now to take another quick break, but when we return, we'll hear about this year's winners of the 89th Innisfield Wolf Book Awards. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Anna Huntsman in for Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Anna Huntsman in today for Jenny Hamill. Thanks for spending the hour with us. The winners of the 89th Innisfield Wolf Book Awards were announced last night at the Cuyahoga County Public Library's Parma Snow Branch. It's the only juried prize for works which confront racism and celebrate diversity. IdeaStream's Kabir Bhatia spoke with Nicholas Roman Lewis, director of the awards for the Cleveland Foundation. Lewis began by discussing how this year's winners fit within the pantheon of hundreds of authors who have been recognized since 1935.
Looking at the pantheon, these authors, the through line is very clear because it's about representation. So everything that the Innisfield Wolf Book Award stands for is, you know, trying to bring a reader into an understanding of someone's culture. And you can take any of these books throughout the canon. We always kind of go back to, you know, Toni Morrison or Langston Hughes, but someone the other day actually brought up, don't forget Martin Luther King, the author, before he may have been the civil rights icon. So I say that to say that you can look in this canon and pull out stories, human stories, and find your place in them.
And don't we see that in this year's winners? There's Monica Yoon, who won in the poetry category for From From, Nigerian-American author Teju Cole, who won in the fiction category for Tremor, and then Ned Blackhawk, who is an indigenous author, who won for nonfiction for The Rediscovery of America.
Particularly, you look at Ned Blackhawk and The Rediscovery of America, it is taking you to a foundational moment actually before our country started, right? This is, and then my even saying that, our country, it makes you start to question, rightfully so, histories that you've been told. It's making you think, like, what is my relationship to this? In particular, if you look at the work of Monica Yoon, she's looking at Asian identity, and she's even questioning in her poetry her own relationship to what she's been told about her identity. And she does it, you know, so wonderfully, playing with structure and form and all of that. With Tremor, it's such a quiet book, but it has these kind of profound revelations when you let it sit with you. And I think those are the type of things we have books in the canon that, you know, you've got a beloved that is international bestseller, would have some say changed that landscape of literature. And then you have other books that are just quiet that sit with you. So I think we've got books that really touch upon all of that.
Now, even though these books were written a year ago, or maybe started 2 or 3 years ago, did you find, or did the jury find, that the themes were somehow transcendent of time, that they're relevant right up to the present day?
I think what you're getting at is that, is racism, identity, exploring that, something that is primary to our American experience? And the answer is yes. So for Monica Yoon's book of poetry, she's dealing with things that, if you go back to the Asian Exclusion Act, all the way up until now, her book would have been current any time during the last 100 years, right? So to kind of answer that question, if you're a person of color and you're writing about your own experiences, someone else may put a moniker on that as, oh, well, you're writing about race. Well, I'm just writing about myself. And I think that's in the first pages or two of particularly Monica's book. And you look at, you know, Teju Cole, I actually stopped myself in reading it. I said, I think one of the things he does is that he's very particular, because he was born in Nigeria. The names, if you live in this country and are not of, you know, have not had experience, those names don't fall off your tongue. But should they? They should, right? As you should take the time to learn it and all of that. So is he making a statement, or is this is just his world? This is his day-to-day. This is his ordinariness, right?
And does it seem like, finally, as a person of color, we're not seeing books that are, quote unquote, about race? They're books about experiences, as you said. They're just books. They're not books about race.
I would definitely agree with that. However, what has your relationship been to reading? So what type of reader were you, and what type of books did you search out? So being a Black gay man, right, I naturally searched for what I could find to have some kind of reflection of me. So if you're looking at, so if I answer it coming from a personal question, I might say that I've always searched that. But if I'm looking at it maybe from academic, or really looking at the publishing world, I would agree with you. It's just, and I think it's an issue of access, that people do have more access to tell their stories. It is acceptable over, you know, I don't know, maybe the last 20 years. I mean, I will credit Oprah, actually, you know, that the whole notion of there's weight and there's importance in reading and literature. And then they're going the other step, if you are a writer, if you are a creative, that we're going to support you. So I think you just have more of that now.
And that's a good thing, right?
It's absolutely wonderful. And for me, and in my role here, yes, this is about race. It's an exploration of it. The other side of that, where are we trying to get to? It's a celebration of human diversity, because we're trying to get to a place where we can all be celebrated, all understand, where you can understand someone else's story, ultimately as your own, right? And so that we're looking at this as a tool. This literature is something that we can use as tools for social justice, or even that sounds like a really big word, but a tool for your own personal change. And that's what I think is really exciting about this canon.
And we haven't talked yet about the Lifetime Achievement winner, Maxine Hong Kingston.
You know, honestly, Kabir, I was trying to think what I could say that hasn't been said about Maxine Hong Kingston without just reading a quote. So first of all, she's iconic. Her book, The Woman Warrior, I think it's a seminal work. Like some of these other type of books that shook the country, it has a life outside of just being literature, because it really had a like a cultural moment, is what I'm trying to get at, that people then were able to use this craft, this book, this work to really start to change their lives in certain ways, or at least we'll say how you perceived people. But what I have learned most recently is I did not know her work as a peace activist. And I think that clearly is something that we should elevate, because again, it's this connection to why are we doing this work? You know, why did Edith Anisfield Wolf create this book award in 1935? She wanted to change. She wanted the world to be a better place. Clearly there were certain things happening in 1935 with her being a Jewish woman that are relevant today, but that whole through line of she's doing this to make a difference. And I think you can see some of that in a lot of our Lifetime Achievement winners, to be frank, because they have been honored for that. Their work has made that difference. But, you know, Maxine Hong Kingston really exemplifies that.
That's Nicholas Roman Lewis, director of the Anisfield Wolf Book Awards, in conversation with Ideastream's Kabir Bhatia. To get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter, now X, at Sound of Ideas, and you can follow me at @AnnaHuntsman_. Tomorrow, Marlene Harris-Taylor is in the host chair. She'll discuss a new network of organizations coming together to help the grieving families of homicide victims. If you missed any portion of this program, you can find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. I'm Anna Huntsman, in for Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening.